We're going to start off this afternoon talking about link and rest inside of SharePoint. So in a previous session, Jan was dealing with the client object model, and I'm sure you guys are pretty impressed with the types of things you can do with the client object model. These topics we're going to do sort of extend what you've been talking about in that all of these technologies are really things that you can do that are interacting with lists, right? So the client object model is limited to the site collection and below, and a lot of what you do with the client object model is dealing with data in lists. And the same is true with link and rest. So these represent all the technologies that we use to access data inside of SharePoint, new things that we're doing. So why should you care about these? Well, let's talk about link first, so we'll begin with that. So link, language integrated query. How many folks in here have written a link query? I've written a link query. Got a few hands. Good. All right, so for those that haven't, let's think about why we should care about this. So let's take a step back to something we all know, like a SQL statement. So think about writing a SQL statement. A SQL statement is something that we write that lives between quotes, and we don't really know if it's right, if it's correct, until we run the code, right? So it's something that we write that doesn't give us any validation during compile time. Then we run it, and hopefully it's right, you know, usually not the first time. And you go, oh, okay, go back and look at it and sort of pick through it. Additionally, it's also something that we don't get any IntelliSense for. So if you're writing a dynamic SQL query inside of Visual Studio, it's not like you're getting any help from Visual Studio writing that correctly. The third reason that we care about this discussion really has to do with all the other types of things that we query. So think about these two drawbacks that we have with standard SQL, which is it's text-based. We don't know until runtime whether it fails, and we don't get any IntelliSense help. And now extend that thinking into other types of data that you go after. So think about XML, for example. So when we go to XML and we query it, maybe we have to know something about the structure. We use a different technology to query against it. We have to write XPath queries. And I don't know about you guys, but I could never get it right. I'm always like forward slash dot. What's supposed to come next? You know, that kind of thing. So the point of the discussion here is that if you consider the state of data access technology, we have to use a lot of different technologies to get a lot to a lot of different data stores. And they suffer from these drawbacks of being primarily text-based. And, you know, I have to learn a different language, whether it's XPath, pardon me, or SQL, depending upon what it is that I'm querying. So the idea behind link, or language integrated query, is that we want to create a single query language that we can use that overcomes all these limitations. So rather than being a text-based query language, you want it to be an object-based query language. Give us some help in IntelliSense to create the query. Let us know at compile time whether or not the query is valid instead of waiting till runtime. And also to be able to use the same kind of technique regardless of the back end. I mean, in all seriousness, as a developer, what do we really care about the fourth normal structure of the database? I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in how I get data in and out of the database. And another term that you'll hear a lot across this whole topic is the idea of an object relational model, or an ORM, an object relational model. An object relational model is built into the idea of entity framework, which you've probably heard about, which is taking a layer of objects and putting them on top of a database so that you can talk to the objects instead of having to worry about the table structure. So let's take a look at a quick sample here so we can see why we care about link. And I'm just going to go ahead and jump into SharePoint here. Okay, it would help if I was actually in the VM. There we go, better. Okay, so here I am inside of SharePoint. I just have a very simple web part here that is going to run some queries on different kinds of data. So I can come over here. Let's just do a quick reload of this thing here so we can start from scratch. So when it comes to my web part here that's empty, and then on the left over here, I just have some links that we can click. So this first one is do a query of files. So if you look in the list box now, you can see that what I'm returning are files and folders from the root drive, on my C drive there, right? So we brought back some information about files and folders. How about processes that are running on this server? Click on this one, and it brings back a list of the different processes that are running on the server. Okay, so that's nice. How about an array? So you have to trust me, under the covers we have an array there. Got some information in it. We're bringing back information from an array. An XML document. Here we are bringing back some information from XML. I can even run it against a database. So here I am clicking on a SQL query and bringing back a bunch of names from the good old VentureWorks database, a piece of that in the background. So the point here is that what you're seeing is I'm querying a bunch of different data sources, and I'm using this one web part to do it. So let's take a quick look at the code that made that happen. So pop open Visual Studio. Should have this guy in the recent list. Here it is. Okay, so this is, as I said, just a web part. There's nothing really exciting about this. If you look over here, you can see that we've got a web part project. And if I go down a little bit, we really just have one place where the code is in here, and we've got that open. So let's go ahead and go full screen on this so we can see it. So just kind of working our way from the top here, let's come down to the first click. This is where I showed the files. So we're going to focus our attention just in this section right here. And you can see this is, you know, this is where we come in when we click on it. And we come in here and we have this directory info, DI, equals new directory info, and I'm looking at the C drive. So there's nothing magical about that. That's not link, right? That's just something I can do in the .NET framework. But what's important about what's going on here when I get this directory info object is that this object supports IEnumerable and IQueryable. So IEnumerable and IQueryable are two interfaces introduced into the C# language that basically advertise that this particular collection can be queried, and then the results of that collection we can enumerate through it. And you're going to see both of those things go on here. So this next piece is where I actually run the query. So here I am running a query against it. Let's look at that in some detail here. From D, D is just a variable here, it could be anything, in di.getDirectories. So getDirectories is going to return the directories from the directory info object. And then we're saying order this by the name of the directories and then select directory name. So what does this do? Well, if you've written, you know, for those of you who have done link, you'll recognize this structure, pretty basic. For those that haven't done link, you know, this pretty much looks like a SQL query, right? So you have kind of a select statement. You're saying you want to order it in a particular way. But what's really cool about this is not a text-based query. This is an object-based query, so that if I come in here to DI, for example, and I want it to order by something other than name, you can see that when I put in the dot there that I get IntelliSense help. So Visual Studio clearly knows what this is. It knows that there are different attributes associated with it. It helps me write that query. So I'm going to know at compile time whether or not this particular query is valid. Now, what you're looking at, link is a subject that, you know, we could spend a day talking about anyway. And one of the things I really like to make clear to SharePoint developers is that if you are not well-versed in link, you need to put that at the top of your list of things to do. What you'll see is that more and more as we do things in data access, that link comes up again and again and again. My guess is you saw it in the client object model work that Jan was doing as well, right? So it really does come up again and again and again. So in my opinion, a fundamental skill for SharePoint developers. So if you're not skilled in that, again, I put it at the top of the list. And what you're looking at here, this structure right here, this query structure right here, this is pretty standard stuff that you see an awful lot. This is called query syntax. It's called query syntax for obvious reasons. It looks like a SQL query. But what's interesting is if you walk through all the different language enhancements that C# brings, you'll see that what this really is a single statement that makes use of a bunch of C# enhancements specifically designed to allow you to write it this way. But there's also something called method syntax. And in method syntax, you use methods like dot where, and then parentheses, and your where clause goes inside. And what's interesting about method syntax is method syntax really shows you that link is nothing more than a programmatic statement that has methods and arguments in the methods and that type of thing. But they've sort of given you this different way to write it called query syntax because it looks much more like what we're familiar with. So my point there is just to rest assured that what you're looking at is really, it's really code that calls methods and has arguments, but it's written in a way to help it look a lot like a database query. Other things that are interesting about this very simple query is the use of the new keyword. So when you use link, you'll see this select statement at the end, right? Just like a select in any query. And then sometimes you'll see this new keyword and sometimes you won't. So what's going on with that? Well, if you see the new keyword, what's happening is the results of your query are being projected into a brand new set of objects. So you basically get the results copied into a new set of objects. Why do you care about that? You care about that because if the results are copied into a new set of objects, you can't update them. So you basically get yourself a disconnected record set that you can do whatever you want with, so you can show them in a list like we're doing, but you're not going to be able to change the values of them and write them back because you basically have copied them out. So in the absence of the new keyword, what's going to happen is the results will actually come back as editable, and then the results in either case are being placed into this variable Q. Now, another interesting thing about this query is the use of this var Q right here. So var is a new keyword inside the C# language that basically allows you to declare a variable without knowing its type. Now, don't worry, this isn't like the old variant in Visual Basic 3 where you just sort of declared a variable and it magically became whatever it is that you wanted. This is really a strongly typed variable, but the what's interesting about the var keyword is that the strong typing occurs at compile time. So what happens is the compiler looks at your query and it says, oh, this is the type of thing that's coming back from that query, and then var Q becomes that type. And what's interesting about that for us is that really frees us from the burden of trying to work through what exactly is coming back from the query. You just sort of catch it in this var variable and then use it later. So this is a pretty standard way to go. So now you should be able to see that basically what I'm doing is getting all the directories in the root of C. I'm getting new ones, copying them into objects there, and they'll be in var Q. So that's your I queryable. And the key thing here is that I'm able to do this. I can write this code because this collection, the get directories, implements iQueryable. It advertises that you're allowed to write link statements against it. In any case, once I have my results then, the next thing I do is loop through them and go ahead and put them in the list. So here you see me just looping through them and putting them in the list. Now the results don't actually come back from the source until you hit them. So it's in the looping process that I'm actually getting my results back from the source. But this is a pretty standard pattern to run a select statement like this and then loop through it and put the results into, something like a list or a grid or what have you. All right, let's go down to the next one here where I showed the processes that were on the computer. So here I am with another link statement. And you can see this one says from P in process.getProcesses. So again, the getProcesses implements iQueryable, which means that it's saying you can write link statements against me. And then what we do is we come in here and we're ordering now, descending, select new process name. So this gets me all the names of all the processes. But what's important about this, and I think you can see it already, right, is I'm basically using the same query against a completely different source, one's files and one's processes. But again, once I have them, because it implements IEnumerable, we can loop through them and put them inside the list. And as we saw, the same thing works on arrays. So here I am creating an array of strings. And then I write a query here that says from n in names, there's names, where n contains cap s. Well, there's only one answer to that. Scott contains cap s. Order by n, select n. Notice we're not using the new keyword here, just bringing back those results without copying them into something. Loop through them, and in this case, we saw that just Scott came back, and we put that inside the list. But again, same basic pattern. How about XML? Well, here we have some XML, a string of XML here. Okay, and you can see that this is contacts, plural. There's a contact inside, then first name, last name. You get the idea. Now, what's interesting to me about the XML part of all this is this is where we see that our dream of having a single query language work the same against everything isn't quite there yet. And the reason we can see that is because we actually have to take the XML and put it in a separate object here, this one called an X document. So it is an X document that implements the iQueryable, iEnumerable portions that are going to allow us to actually run the link query. So if the XML is in, you know, a standard XML document or something, you're not going to be able to do it. You have to load it into one of these X documents. And then when you run your, write your query, you can see that we can write the query. There's D, right, for our X document. And we're saying d.descendants contacts. So we're looking in all the set of contacts that are in the XML, and we're pulling out the first name for each one of those. Now, the other thing that's interesting about this is that although I can sort of claim this is the same pattern, write, query, loop through results, it should be clear, that this query requires you to know a little something about the XML, right? So I have to know there are contacts inside of it, and I have to know that there's a first name attribute. So you can see, we're not quite at that point. We actually have to understand the XML document a little more than perhaps we'd want to in the ideal world. But nonetheless, to me, this is so much better than XPath, right? I can get this right. I have IntelliSense to help me out. If you're doing anything with OpenXML 2, anybody in here doing work with Office 2007 and OpenXML 2? A few. Okay. I also think that's another fantastic area of development for folks to get involved with, and also works really well with a lot of things we do in SharePoint. But as you all know, all the Office formats now are OpenXML, so it's basically XML under the covers, right? So what you're looking at right here is an incredibly easy way to create and consume Office documents. So if you give me an Office document, I can write link against it and pull things out of it. Now stop and think about that for a second. So now I'm using the same pattern to get structured and unstructured data. Okay, it's structured under the covers, but it's a document, right? So this is a very powerful skill for us to be able to do these things and really facilitates our SharePoint development. All right, moving down then, the next sort of special one we have here was the SQL one. So here we are, click on the SQL, and now what we're doing is running a query against a database. Now, this is also a bit special here because we have a different provider. So just like we had an X document for XML, for SQL, we also have a different provider. And you can see that I've got this interesting class here called MiniCRM. What the heck is that all about? Well, in order to use link against databases, what you need to do is create an intermediate set of objects called the object relational map, as I mentioned before, or the ORM. So once the ORM layer is created, then you can run link against the objects in the ORM and not worry about the structure of the database. The primary way that we do that as developers is to use the entity framework. So you can create a data layer in your projects and use the entity framework to create an ORM and then run link against the ORM, just like you see here. So the reason I have this mini CRM is because mini CRM is actually the name of the database, and in the entity framework, or its junior cousin called link to SQL, what happens is you get an object that is the name of the database, and then when you create a new one, you pass in the connection string. So you can see here I've passed in the connection string. So this is like your connection. This is like your SQL connection object, but it's an object-oriented way to do it. It represents the database itself. Well, once I have this, the reason I'm using the variable DC is that one of the things you'll hear over and over again is the idea of a data context. So SharePoint has this over and over in many places. Every single time that you want to talk to something in SharePoint, primarily lists, you need to get a context to do it. Well, we understand the idea of getting contexts from an SP context object, right? So if you want to do anything using the server-side object model, you need to get a context. The same is true, as you saw previously, for the client object model. If you want to use the client object model against something, you need to have a context which says which site am I talking to. If I want to talk to a database, I need a context. So this idea occurs over and over and over again, getting the context, and that's what this is. This is our data context. But once you have the data context, then you'll see that you can come in, pardon me, you can come in and write link queries against it. So here I am using that data context, and that data context is going to contain information about all of the different entities that I can query against. In this case, mini-CRM underscore names happens to be the table that has names inside of it. But these can be other entities as well. You get the idea. And what happens in Link is that as you query and make changes to these objects in your code, it is the job of the data context to track the changes for you, so that then when you write them back, it knows how to write all those changes back. And then you're just freed to deal with these things as objects instead of worrying about table structure. Another thing that's interesting here is that you can see I've put parentheses around my link query, and then I've used a method toArray, and I've returned a mini CRM underscore names, an array of those, instead of using var this time. So it's also another very common thing to take those results and sort of transform them into something else you might need in line like that and walk away with an array as an example. But you can also see that once I've got them, you know, then I can just loop through them again, and we basically have the same pattern, which is write link statement, loop through results. And finally, we can do it with objects as well. So here's an example that's building up a generic list of contacts, so a new list of instructors. Just as a quick sidebar here, you can see I have a class for instructors down here, so that's where it's coming from. So I'm just building up a quick list of instructor objects, and then I add some new instructors inside. Now, I'm going to pause here for a second, too, because what you're seeing here is a very short way to create a collection. I'll draw your attention to this. And these are all language enhancements that are in C#. So C# gives us a way to shortcut the creation of objects, to assign their values to them, and then to create a collection. So you can see how compact this code is. And in fact, Link uses a lot of these same enhancements to make its statements very compact. So, for example, when I use the new keyword, you saw me use the new keyword, and I said to you that's copying into some new objects, and that's why it's there. It's using these same shortcuts to pull that off. So a lot of the language enhancements that you'll see in people's code actually were created to support Link, but we can use them in other places in our code as well. At any rate, once we've got our generic list of contacts, I can come down here and just do a select right out of it. So again, you see the same pattern. It's getting boring by now. And then loop through the results. Okay. So that's the key thing there, is that, you know, this is really the reason why you care about Link, is that it gives you this way to use this same pattern regardless of what you're after. And I personally can't remember the last time I wrote an ADO.NET line of code. I just don't do it anymore. Everything I do in Link. It's a core skill, and one you will definitely want to focus on. Okay, so having seen that, let's jump back to our slide deck here for a second. And let's talk a little bit now. Let's go specifically into Link to SharePoint. Okay, so what's Link to SharePoint all about? Well, just like we wanted to be able to write link statements for all kinds of other data sources, be they XML or databases or what have you, we'd like to be able to do the same thing with our lists in SharePoint. So what Link to SharePoint is a provider that allows us to write link statements against lists in SharePoint. Now, why do you care about it? You care about it for the same reasons we care about all the other providers. We don't have to write any text-based query stuff anymore. So that means no more camels. So how many folks in here have written a camel query? Got a bunch of hands. Great. So it says no camel. I mean, I guess I should say that there are still instances where camel is the only way to really write particular aspects of a query. So in some advanced scenarios, link to SharePoint might not support a particular thing you're trying to do. So you might find yourself back in CAML. So don't completely lose all your CAML knowledge at this point. But for a lot of the basics, you know, 80% of the stuff you want to do, no CAML required. Instead of writing things between quotes, we'll simply use objects. We have entity classes to form the business layer, so we're going to get an ORM. So we're going to create an object relational map that allows us to go against the objects instead of the list directly. As we said, strongly typed queries, compile time checking, IntelliSense, all that good stuff. The last bullet down here shows you the assembly where you can find link. So if you want to do any link to SharePoint stuff, you're going to be setting a reference there. Okay, so how do we use it? Well, basically what we have to do in order to use link to SharePoint is we've got to accomplish these three things here. Creating the entity classes, so developing our object relational map. Creating a data context, because just like all the other data sources we talked about, we need a data context in order to access the site and say what lists we're interested in, and then finally write some queries against it. Okay, so we're going to start with the creating of the entity classes. The way that the entity classes are created and linked to SharePoint is they're generated from a utility called SPMetal. This borrows from the paradigm that was used in link to SQL, which really isn't cool anymore. We don't do any link to SQL stuff. That was kind of the little brother of entity framework. An entity framework is all integrated into Visual Studio now. But we have to use this command line utility in order to generate ours. You can see the very simple syntax is just SPMetal. Oh, let's go back. SPMetal, and then we specify the web that we're interested in and the code that we're interested in right there. So let's exit this and look at a sample before we dig any deeper. Yeah, we'll jump over to another site here. Okay, on this particular site here, I want to draw your attention to a couple of lists that we have. So one list is this one here called the modules list. So the modules list just has a list of training modules in it. You can see we've got a module ID, we have a title for each one, which instructor we're going to have, and then the instructor's email address. We also have a list of instructors. So here are the list of instructors. You can see we have Amy, Brian, and Scott. And let's go back to the modules. And you can see that we've got Amy, Brian, and Scott. And this is because the modules list is using the instructor list as a lookup, right? So this is something that we've seen. We do this in 2007. You can have a lookup list, right? And as we were discussing this morning in the sort of overview session, when you have a lookup list in 2010 now, you can have these additional fields that you specify. So in this case, we've said, well, also give me the email address of the instructor, because you might want that, right? If you're looking at the module title, you say, oh, Amy's teaching that. Let's go ahead and contact Amy. And so the additional field email is actually coming from the instructor list. Jump back here. There it is, the email address coming from the instructor list. And we call these projected fields. These are projected fields because what they do is they project into the lookup list and retrieve those values and show them in the first list. Now, when people show this, right, they'll often use a term that I'm a little uncomfortable with. They'll say the lists are joined. And then they show you, as Jan was doing, they show you how you get cascade delete functionality. And the reason that I'm mildly uncomfortable with that description of how this all works is that it leads everyone to believe that these are like database tables. So one of the challenges that I have when I go out and do a lot of work with customers is that a lot of folks tend to think of lists almost as if they were database tables. So instead of making a database, I'm just going to make some lists. And this idea that lists can be joined and that they have cascading delete functionality sort of enhances that idea that, hey, maybe at some point I'm just not even going to have to write databases anymore because it'll all just be lists. Well, that's not really correct. Lists are not databases and should never be confused with them. And I always find myself wishing they'd come up with a little bit different terminology for these capabilities that we have. But stuck with what we're stuck with, when we say that lists are joined in SharePoint, all we really mean is one is using a lookup list in the other. And that's it. There's nothing more to it than that. It's no more fancy than that. It doesn't offer you anything more than that. That is the join. So when we have that join, then we have this idea of the projected projected fields that we can look into. So you can't get any relationship at all between two lists unless one is using the other as a lookup, and then they're joined. Very important thing. And so when you think about that, it should be clear to you then that there are times when a database is required. And so there are going to be applications you create where it's going to need the kind of functionality that a database offers you, and a list should never be used for that. Lists are really primarily intended to be human readable, right? It's like if I give my wife a list of groceries to get or something, right? She's supposed to be able to read it. She shouldn't have to know the fourth normal form to know that we need more milk, right? That kind of thing. So we're presenting these directly to people, and they do have the limitations that go along with that. Okay. So having seen the structure of the lists here, then what we can do is we can write link queries against those joins. So I'm going to show you a solution here, and then we'll take a look at the code and see how it was created. Okay, so we've got a very simple web part here that's showing a list of modules. And along with the list of modules, you can see that we have the instructor for each module in parentheses next to it. So here we are creating a view programmatically across two lists, right? See how that works? And if I come in here and I click on one of these guys, let's do printing lists. And then you can see that what we do is we retrieve the title of the module down here where it says printing lists. And I'm just going to change this one to printing a list like that and go ahead and click update. And when I do it, it takes a second. Okay, does its thing there. And you can see now it says printing a list up here at the top. And if I go back to the home page here and we look at the modules, we can see it says printing a list right there. Okay, so we're programmatically joining the list together. And not only are we reading them, we're also writing as well. So let's go ahead and see how that was done. And let's see, I don't see it right there on my list. Let's do an open. I believe that's lesson 4. Looks good. Let's go ahead and open that up. Okay, so this is nothing more than a web part. So a lot going on over here, just a web part involved. But let's talk about what we have to do first. So before we create our web part and actually write our query, the very first thing I said that we had to do was to create our ORM, our object relational model, our entities. And the way that we were going to do that is with SPMetal. So I'm going to open up a little batch file here that has what we need. And the first thing I'm going to point out to you is the location of SPMetal. So here we are with our magic directory, right? C, program files, common files, Microsoft Shared, web server extensions, 14. If you're a SharePoint developer, you know it because you can recite this in your sleep, right? We all know this little path right here. And by the way, what do you call the 14 folder anyway? What do you guys call that? Anybody have a name for that? Just call it 14? So somebody says it's in the hive. It's a hive, right? Some people call it the hive. I believe the proper name for it is the system directory, although I'm sure I've heard about 3 different names for it. But when I say system directory, that's what I mean, the 14. So under the system directory, there's a folder bin, and in there is where you'll find SPMetal. And if we just scroll across a little bit, we can see some of the arguments for it. So the first thing I said that we needed was the web. So here's the web argument, and we are looking at... scroll back over. And we are looking at this particular URL. This is the one that we care about. All right? So we're asking SPMetal to look in there. And then I'm going to skip this parameters one for a second. And let's scroll past that You know what? Let's put in a carriage return here so we don't have to jump around so much. Okay. So we're going to skip the parameters one for just a sec. And then we'll come to the language one right here. And let's go ahead and break them all out. There's code. Okay, so these should be pretty obvious, right? Language is C#. So I'm going to generate a C# code module. And then the name of the code module is entities.cs. So when this batch file runs, it's going to build an object relational map for me that is in entities.cs. And based off of lists that it finds in wingtip server /10. Now, if you stop and you think about this for a second, generating entities off of a particular web that you have could be problematic because you're probably in your development environment. So in this particular environment that you're in, you probably have all kinds of lists that you're using for various tests that don't have anything to do with the particular feature that you're trying to create. So I don't just want some blanket thing where I say, hey, you know, go to this site and create a bunch of objects for me that represent classes for me that represent all the lists that you find there. Instead, I want to be much more particular, so I want to be able to say what it is exactly that I need classes generated for. And that's where parameters XML comes into play. So parameters XML is going to allow me to construct a more detailed definition of what it is that I need generated. So let's take a look at that one. Here's our parameters XML. All right, so parameters XML begins with the web element. See the web element here? And the web element has an attribute class, and it has an access modifier public. That means that I want it to generate an entities, a class name entities with a public modifier. And that's going to be my data context that gets created. And then underneath it, I specify first the lists that I care about. So you can see that I've got a list element here. I say I'd like to generate for the instructors lists. And I'm going to have a class name in instructors. And then underneath each list, and it's normally what SPMetal wants to do is it wants to go to every content type in every list and for every field and generate your classes using all that information, right? So we're saying, okay, go to the instructor's list, but only locate the content type called contact. That's the only one I'm interested in. So if there are multiple content types on that list, we're just going to worry about the content type called contact. And by the way, I also only care about full names, so just generate full name for me. I don't need anything else. So all the other fields, you can leave them alone. And then you can see that we end the definition of the list here. In the second one, we say, okay, we're interested in this list called modules, right? So here's the modules list. And I haven't specified any content types or fields, so you're going to generate everything for that. So just go look at that list and generate everything there. And then finally, at the bottom, I've said exclude all other lists. So if the list is not here, which means only instructors and modules, don't generate anything for anything else. Just stop at this point. And you know that's important because, as I said, if it's your development environment, then you probably have many lists that you don't care about and don't need anything for that are part of other little things that you're doing. Okay, so when you run the batch file with the parameters XML, then this is what you get. This is the entities.cs right here. And so all you have to do is take this code, which was generated by the tool, and add it into your project. And for example, you can see I've got the class called entities, and it is inheriting from Microsoft.SharePoint.link.dataContext. And that's exactly what I said I wanted, right? I wanted a class named entities that had a public access modifier. And if you were to scroll through this code, you'll see other things that look familiar. Here's the modules list. Scrolling down a little bit, we should be able to find things for various fields that are in the list, right? We didn't put any limit on the fields that should be generated. So you can see we're getting all kinds of fields generated here that we can use. There's one we recognize, title. you get the idea. So we've got a whole class in here that represents the modules list, the instructors list, and the data context. Those are the three big things that we need to be successful. Okay, so once I have the entities in place here inside my project, then I'm free to just go ahead and use it to write link queries. So now's where we come to our web part. This is a non-visual web part. I think they're a little bit easier to show in demonstrations. So it's just a code module here that has everything inside of it I need to be a web part. So let's go ahead and open that guy up. Okay, so top to bottom is all we need to do here. Scroll down a little bit. You can see that we inherit from web part. And the first portion here is my UI. So I've got a list box, text box, label, and button. Those are the things that we had on our web part. Great, no problem there. Create child controls, nothing exciting about this. This is just me building up my UI programmatically. New. And, of course, tying in my event handler for the button right here, which is what we click to do the update. So that's all pretty standard. The fun begins here inside of fill list. So fill list is called when the part loads. So when the part loads, we need a list of all those modules. So you can see how simple the code can be here. So using entities, that's the class we generated, we know that inherits from data context. There's my DC. And it says new entities, and then I have to provide the URL of the website that I want to connect to. So what's interesting about this, right, if you think about what we just looked at with the SQL database stuff, this is analogous to what we did with the SQL database. This is basically a connection string that's connecting to the site that I care about, and my connection string is the URL of the website that I want to connect to. So what that means, the important takeaway here, is that in your development environment, you can use ASP.NET to generate the classes that you want against the list that you have in your development environment. When you go into QA or production, as long as those lists exist with the same content types that you had in your environment, then this code will work because we're basically using the current context to get the URL of the current website. So that as long as those lists and content types are present, this line of code will run regardless of whether you're in dev, QA, or production. And that will give you your connection, your context that you care about. So now off to writing a link query. Here's our link query right here. And you can see that we're doing from m in dc.module. So again, dc is our data context, right? And if I click on dc here, if I put a dot there, we can see that not only are we going to get modules, but there's the other goodies that I want here. Okay, I'm expecting to see my instructors list, but it's making a mockery of me. So the idea here, of course, is that we're getting help from IntelliSense. Our modules is the class that we generated. We're ordering by module ID. Okay, that was one of the fields in the list, right? I showed to you. And then we're doing a select new here, so we all know that new now projects into a new set of objects. And here's some interesting syntax. I'm bringing back the title for my module, and then I'm bringing back the instructor full name, and I'm representing that as presenter. So this syntax is kind of interesting because it's just like in a select statement in SQL where you say, get me this field as something else. So here I am getting the instructor full name as presenter. But then we follow that same pattern, so now I'm going to do the loop through right here. And all I'm doing as the list item is showing the title, and then you remember I had square brackets plus the presenter right there. Now, at this point, I don't care about updating because I'm just filling the list with information, so I went ahead and used the new keyword. Now what happens in the demo is you pick one, so you go up to the list and you select something from the list. So that will fire the selected index change, which is simply going to fill the text value with the information that we picked, and this is nothing more than pulling out a substring, which is everything before the square bracket. All right, so then you look at it and you say, okay, I'm going to update the list title. So I go ahead and change the list title. And then when you press the update button, this code will run right here. And now what we do is get ourselves another data context. And this time we're running another query, but this query is only attempting to bring back the one item that we're changing. So let's take a little bit closer look at this. So we're looking in modules, and we're saying where the title is equal to the text of the selected item. And there's a little parsing going on over here, but basically that's it. So I'm saying, just run out there and get me from the list the one that matches the one that I'm editing. And then as I showed you in the beginning, it's not uncommon to take that query and operate on it directly here inside this line. So what we're doing is pulling out the first one. So we're expecting one thing to come back, right? So we're going to go ahead and use the first method on the results, which should give us the one and only one thing that matches the item that was picked inside the list. Notice that we're doing a select, not a select new. And that means that we'll actually get back something that we can update. It means that the data context is going to track changes to the things that we get back, which is good because now what we're going to do is come up and change the title and put in whatever it was we typed in, call the submit changes method on the data context, and then include our conflict resolution information right here. So basically what's happening is we're saying, okay, you know, here's the change I want you to make to the list, and go ahead and submit that change. But in all these technologies, we have these issues of I go ahead and run a query, and I've got some information, right? And then somebody else comes along and edits that list while I'm holding that information and tracking changes to it, right? Anytime you have a disconnected record set like that, you've always got conflict resolution things that may need to happen. So the way that that's handled inside of Link to SharePoint is that when you submit the changes, you can specify what should happen on conflict. Now, just to be clear, basically if anything inside of your set that you've changed and you're writing back is in conflict with anything else, your changes are going to stop at the point where the conflict is occurring. Okay, so you can see here that we've directed it to fail on first conflict, which means that it's going to make its changes till it hits the first problem, and then it's going to stop, not going to do anything else. Now, you can also tell it to keep going. So you can see that there's another one in here that says continue. Oh, there we go. Continue on conflict. And so what the continue on conflict will do is it will keep trying everything else. Now, nothing else is going to get written in. The purpose in continuing is to accumulate the problems. If you stop after the first problem, then you're only going to know about the first conflict. If you tell it to keep going, then what it's going to do is it's going to build up a whole set of conflicts that you can then look at and decide what it is that you want to do. So in this case, we're not sweating it too much. Just for this demo, we're not even doing anything about it. We're saying just go ahead, and if there's a problem, I'm only changing one thing, and if there's a problem, it's just going to fail at this point. But what if we cared about this, you know, which we probably do for any real production system, right? So let's go ahead and pull open some code here that'll help us deal with that. Okay, so in this sample, we have the ability to generate some conflicts, but let's just go ahead and look at the code in light of what we were just discussing. So basically what happens is that you build up a set of conflicts here. And let me just get to the spot I want to show you. Here we go. And then you catch them using the change conflict exception. So if you get one or more conflicts when you do the update, you're going to fire this change conflict exception. And then you have to decide what it is that you're going to do with it. So you basically get the same options you always get, which are forget their changes, just put mine in, and they'll figure it out later. Be nice and, you know, forget my changes and put theirs in. And if you look down here, you can see that we have a couple of case blocks here that handle all these different things. So case number one is don't do anything, just show me these. So I'm not going to save mine, theirs, or anybody else's at the moment. Just give me information about what's going on. And what you'll see is that we have two collections here. So we have, for our data context, we have a change conflicts. And then the change conflicts has inside of it objects with more detail called member change conflicts. And so I'm looping through both of those collections to pull out three very important things: original value, current value, and database value. Now, this is pretty standard exception handling. We do the same thing with just about any disconnected record set. Basically, what we need to know is, what was the value of this list item when I first got it? What is the value now that I've changed it? And what is the current value in the content database? Because all three could be different, right? And then I can decide. So a conflict is basically defined by the original value is not the same as the current database value, right? It means somebody was there since I was there last. So this is the code that you would use just to retrieve the information and then display it. Simple enough. If we go down to case number one here, this says keep my changes and get rid of theirs. So now what I'm doing, instead of just displaying the information, I'm calling the resolve method, and I'm using the enumeration keep current values. So that basically says, go ahead and put mine in there, forget theirs, just overwrite them. And then, of course, call submit changes once those collections are resolved. Last case, lose my changes. So this is, again, just calling the resolve method. And then we do an overwrite current values and submit changes. And then we're being polite because we've gone ahead and lost our changes and made theirs. And then, of course, we could turn back around, re-query, right, now that we know what the state of the list is, and do the whole thing all over again and hopefully have some merging of their changes and our changes. Okay? But I think the key takeaway from this is that the conflict resolution support in Link to SharePoint is pretty standard. If you've done disconnected record sets, even in SQL, over the years, you'll recognize original value, database value, current value, those types of things. Okay, other things to keep in mind here. These things are all happening in the context of the person who's running the code. So that person actually has to have permissions to perform the operations that you're trying to perform, right? So if they don't have the rights to update the items in the database, you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to get security exceptions when you make that call. Okay, probably got time for a couple questions. If there's a couple of quick questions on Link to SharePoint, anything? Oh, the presentation was so good. There are no questions. Okay, great. Well, certainly if there are, when we're done, I'll be hanging around up here. All right, so now what we're going to do is we're going to change gears a little bit and move away from Link to SharePoint and to WCF Data Services. So let's return to the slides here. So this is a somewhat different topic. So it's almost like two presentations in one here. But again, they're very closely related for two reasons. Both of these technologies are dealing with lists, and both of them are very link heavy. So that's kind of why they always end up getting put together. But what we're talking about now is the proper term for the thing we're discussing is something called WCF Data Services. WCF Data Services. So what does WCF Data Services do for us? It provides what we call a RESTful interface to SharePoint. Now, some people are familiar with REST. It's been around for a long time. Others, the concept is new to them. But it's actually something that we all deal with every day. Because what REST says, if we think about the way, the paradigm that we typically have as programmers, if we need to get information or perform an operation on something, we are geared around this idea of calling a method and passing in an argument and getting a return value, right? That's like 101 stuff. And so we sort of think about things that way. But what REST says is that instead of using this remote procedure call idea, there's a method, I pass in an argument, it passes me back a value, I should instead be able to perform operations simply by specifying a URI. So again, if this is the first time you've ever run into it, it can be kind of confusing. You say, wait a second, how do you pass arguments in using a URI? Well, the truth is that you do it every day, thousands of times a day, every time you use your browser and you visit a website. All right, so basically what happens in a website, if you type in, you know, www.cnn.com, whatever, or SharePoint/default.aspx, you're performing an operation and you're asking for information to be returned, all contained in the context of that URL. And so your request is answered with HTML coming back. That's REST. REST says that you can build up this URI, and it has inherent in the structure of the URI what it is that you're asking for, and then the information that should be returned. And because HTTP supports puts and gets, right, and deletes, we should be able to perform full CRUD operations by doing nothing more than specifying URIs. The way that this is implemented inside SharePoint is through a WCF data service. So another thing that if you've been around WCF and REST for a while, you're back there going, oh yeah, I know all this, because WCF has been able to do REST forever. Most people haven't done that. They've used SOAP, right? So remote procedure calls using SOAP. So most developers that create services, they create them using that paradigm. You pass me an argument, I pass you a value back. But WCF has supported REST for a long time, and that's the way it's implemented inside of SharePoint. So let's go to another site here and check it out. So what we're going to do to demo this, and Jan did a little bit of this in the overview as well, we're going to issue some URIs to return some information. And let's go ahead and bring up Notepad here so we can build up some of these URIs and take a look at them. Okay, so the first thing we're going to do is just ask for all the lists. So here we are. We're on this site called 10 Solutions. And we're going to click on this URL right here to bring up information about all the different lists. So the first thing to note here is the URI that we're issuing. So I'm going to pull these out and sort of collect them here. Okay, so here's the first one. It starts with the site we care about, Wingtip Server 10, and then _VTI_bin_list_data_svc. So it is the list data SVC WCF service that is implementing the RESTful interface. That's the one. And if you call it directly with nothing else, you just call it directly referencing the site you care about, in this case the 10 site, then what it does is it returns information about all of the lists on that site, right? That's the default behavior. It says, if you create that URI, you're asking me for information about all the lists on the site. It returns it back to you in this atom format here. But basically, if you look through it, you can see that we have contacts, documents, images, instructors, master page gallery. So you can see it's sending back to me information about all the lists that are on the site. Well, that's nice. I can take it further. Let's look at a particular list. So in this case, we're going to return information about the modules list itself. So we'll open this up. And let's go ahead and copy this one out and paste it here. Okay, so now you can see that the difference is I put on /modules. That's how I've modified the URI. And basically, that's telling the service that what I want is information about this particular list. And again, getting it back as an atom feed here, you can see that I'm getting information about the particular list, instructor, created by, modified by. Okay. Scroll down a little bit. Okay. You can also see I'm getting the actual items here. So there's one of our modules, opening links in new windows. Okay. So this is all information about that particular list. But wait, it gets even better. Let's go in and say, let's be a little bit more particular. Let's say I would only like information about the first item in that list. So we'll go ahead and run this one. And again, let's pull the URI so we can see that. And look at the difference. So here we are now referencing modules and then parentheses the ID of the item that we want to create, that we'd like. So we like the first item here. And if we look through this and scroll down a little bit, you can see the first item is preparing a Visual Studio 2010 development environment. And that would certainly be number one in any training you're doing, right? So that's our first item in the list. More things we can do. Let's order them by title. So here comes back information. Let's pull the URI. Ordered by title. Okay. So here we are with question mark. So we have a query string argument, dollar sign order by equals title. So you can issue SQL-like statements like that using this syntax. And other stuff, how about this, the top two? This is an interesting one, and let's just pull the URI so we can check them out here. So I only want the first two, so here I am just saying, give me the top two. Well, I care about top because top really enables something pretty powerful here, which is the ability to page. So let's just get page two. So in this case, what we're doing is we're just getting, we're paging by twos, and I'd like the second page. So you can see if we roll down here that we're getting querying and joining lists, and the one above it, and opening links in new windows, okay? So we're getting these two, opening links and querying and joining, and if we pull the URI, now you can see that what we said is skip the first two and then give me the top two after that. So that essentially gives you the next page of items. And if we go back to our modules here, bring that up, you can see that number three is opening lists in new windows and number four querying and joining lists. So we did indeed get the second page when we were paging. All right, and it goes on and on like that. So here's an example selecting columns. I think Jan actually showed this one in the overview session. But this says, just bring me back the title column. And the last one we've got here is a starts with, always good. Let's do that one. Pull this URI. And here we are issuing a starts with, so we can do a wildcard search, right? So this is a result that says, just get me items that start with accessing, the word accessing. And sure enough, we've got accessing lists with rich clients, accessing, oh, that's the same one, scrolling down. Accessing lists with Silverlight, you get the idea. So we've got a nice wildcard query going there. Okay, so this makes for a great demo, right? You'd be right to sit there and go, okay, I get it, but why do I care about this? Well, the reason that you care about this is many and varied. First of all, there is nothing more universally cross-platform than a URI. So this is really powerful because if you think about it, any other technology that you have that can formulate an HTTP get or put or delete can now interact with a SharePoint list. That to me is a very, very powerful thing, right? So now that old IBM thing you got in the corner, as long as you can write something over there that can issue HTTP requests, you can read and write to SharePoint. Now, all of this happens in the context of the person who is running it, right? So there's still you haven't bypassed any security here. When you go to do this, it has to have security context around it. Okay, but the other thing that's really cool about this is, It is remarkably easy to create client-side applications using this technology because SharePoint, Visual Studio 2010 understands WCF data services, and it understands how to make a proxy for you in your project that you can use to use this interface without actually having to construct the URIs. So it will make the ORM, the object relation mapping, for you in the form of a proxy. Let me show you what I mean. Let's go here to a project I've got here. Let's see, rich list, okay? All right, so the idea behind this particular project that we've got here is that we are going to make a rich client. So this is a Windows application. Here's my Windows application. And what I'd like to be able to do is I'd like to be able to come to this particular site with this particular list. Okay, this one in data access. So on my data access site, I have this tasks list right here, just a standard task list. There's nothing special about it. But what I'd like to be able to do is I'd like to be able to work on this list from a rich client application instead of having to go into SharePoint to do it. So in order to make this happen, I have two ways that that I can get started. And so basically you see here, here's my interface, right? So I just have a rich client with a grid, and this is where we're going to be able to put our tasks and show everything. So I have two ways of making this work. One is I can simply go to the service reference here and add a service reference to the site where I would like to get my data. So that's going to be this URL right here, right? This is wingtip server, data access, and then the /VTI underscore bin list data SVC. So I'm simply referencing list data SVC as a service reference, which is something we do all the time, right? We do that all the time. So let's go ahead and click go. And it's chugging. And it's chugging. And it makes a liar out of me. And things were going so well, weren't they? All right, so it doesn't like something. I believe the URL is typed correctly. Wingtip server, data access, underscore VTI. Yes, this is the correct URL. I think something got goofed up when I connected my laptop to the hardwire here, and I have some kind of bad DNS running around, so it can't find it. Okay, but it's not going to stop us. We're going to keep going. So first thing you could do, you could just simply set a reference to this web service in exactly the way that I'm doing it right here. The other way to get connected is to come to the data menu and say, let's add a new data source. And here inside of Visual Studio 2010, you can pick SharePoint as a data source. Very cool. Then click Next. And then what it does is it takes you back to this exact same place where it's going to do the exact same thing, right? Let's drop it down and see if... What's that definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result? Let's do it again anyway. All right, so here we are. There it is. You can tell I've been there several times. And we click Go. And it doesn't like it. So something's wrong with the resolution of this URL. Okay? And then you would get a new data source. Then what happens is when you get your data source, either way, whether you got your data source by setting a reference in the service references over here in the Solution Explorer, or whether you got your reference by going into the data menu here and adding a new data source, you can come and say show data sources. And then what's going to happen is it's going to appear here inside the data sources window, and you can literally drag that data source and plop it right onto the form. See how cool that demo would be? That would be cool. And then you're connected, okay? And if you think about it, You're doing all that, and I don't have to understand anything about the URI structures that are getting issued. What happens when you add the new data source or you make a service reference to listdata.svc is a proxy class gets built for you that represents all of the things that you can talk to. And now Visual Studio is taking care of issuing the HTTP commands for me. I don't need to know and I don't need to care about that anymore. And then what we can do is focus on code, which I can show you. We can look at the code, which is phenomenally simple. So once you've got your connection in place, you can see right here that, you know, there's my bad list data reference. You can see that what I do is just get a data context again, and the data context takes as an argument, just like it always does, the URI is the site that you want to talk to. In this case, we're including our list data SVC. You can't use the SP context the way that I did in other demos because we're on the client now, right? So I need an app.config or something like that that has the URI in it that I'm going to talk to, and here we just hard-coded it. But once you get your data access, then here on form load, all I'm doing is running my link statement. So I set the credentials to just the person who's running the code, and then I come down here and I build up a link statement. So this one says, give me all of the tasks. And then this is going into a data source here, and basically I'm using data binding. And the moment I run this query and this thing loads, I get everything. Now, what's interesting about this is you could also come in here and say, you know, things like where t dot start date or end date or what have you is or due date, those types of things, right? So we could do like a due date. And basically what I'm saying is I can bring back tasks that are overdue. I can bring back tasks that are not complete yet. So we could say dot complete is less than one, that type of thing. So basically you could write up whatever link statement it is that you want to fill that grid with whatever tasks it is that you need to work on. As we saw in link to SharePoint, it is the job of the context to keep track of the changes that are going on. So as you make changes in the grid, then what's going to happen is each time an item is changed, we're going to notify the context that, hey, this item is changed, so keep track of that for us. And then once we're ready, we can save all the changes out by just using save changes. So a little more code in here, but basically if I scroll these into position here, this is pretty much all the code you need to create a client-side application that securely does CRUD operations on SharePoint lists, all using the RESTful API. So again, the RESTful API is cool because any technology I have, any non-Microsoft technology, anything that can issue HTTP gets and puts and deletes, et cetera, can have full CRUD operations on SharePoint lists. So a great way to do interoperability. And also, I can create client-side applications ridiculously simple, simply by setting reference to list data SVC and basically writing the three sets of code that you see right here. Okay, well, look at that. Our timing is in good shape. So I think we have 15 or a half an hour. Who knows? Do we know? Is it 15? Okay, so I think we've got a 15-minute break here, and then Jan's going to be up with the next round. I'll hang out up here if you have some questions over the break. Other than that, thanks for your attention.